We tried to pull it all together and respond to his accusations. Then the next morning, we all got banned.
Hello and welcome to episode 447 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Nathan Fox. With me is Ben Olson. We are the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. You can be LSAT famous by sharing news or asking questions with us on our website, thinkinglsat.com. We're going to get to a lot of your questions on today's episode. First, I wanted to talk about a free class that I'm doing. We've been doing these about once a month. They're wildly popular. The next one is my class, April 18th, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. It's going to be a standard version of what I do 2 weeknights a week, which is a little bit of LR, a little bit of reading comp. We wrap it up with a game. And all you got to do is go to lsatdemon.com/free. I'll have a whole bunch of help with me in the room, a bunch of professional tutors who will be there as TAs. You can ask all of your questions about absolutely anything during that free class, and the TAs will sort you out. You'll also see an example of some of our classes, one of our classes, mine, that happens 2 weeknights per week in LSAT Demon. Hope to see you there. We have an update here, Ben, on the June 2024 LSAT registration deadline. Why don't you read it?
It says, thanks to listener Ryan, who shared an email he got from LSAC, see the screenshot below, which says, the June LSAT administration's full refund deadline has been extended to May 2nd, 2024, one day after the April score release. If you are also registered for the June LSAT, you will be able to withdraw and receive a full refund after receiving your April score. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they could have just changed the registration deadline to May 2 instead of making people register in it. So you have to register and pay for the June test. Then if you're happy with your April score, you can withdraw and get a refund. Anyway,
seems unnecessarily complicated. Yeah.
Better than nothing. So for those of you who are worried that the April and June test are so close together and you're worried about wasting money, if you crush it in April, that's a non-issue as long as you pay attention when the scores come out and then immediately withdraw by May 2nd from that June test. Ben, we've got a little bit of update on the whole Reddit kerfuffle. This probably, hopefully, will be the last that we'll say about this for a while. Why don't you provide the update of what's happened since last time we talked about this?
Certainly. So 2 weeks ago, we mentioned that we were being shadow banned on our LSAT subreddit. That basically means anyone who comments about the demon or posts about it, their post can be deleted without them knowing it. We made that announcement. We put a post on that subreddit, and a couple days later, Graham responded with a post that basically accused us of socket puppeting or sock puppeting. I'm just learning these terms. Basically having our employees go on and make positive posts about the demon without acknowledging their affiliation. And we looked at his post and tried to go into the examples. He only provided 2 or 3 examples, but I tried to go into them and figure out exactly what was happening. And then we sat down and wrote a response. You looked at it, the whole team looked at it and said, okay, what about this? And we tried to pull it all together and respond to his accusations. And I put that in a comment. And then the next morning, we all got banned. So I can't, that means my account was banned. I can't go on to the RLSAT subreddit and make a post. I can't make a comment. Chris can't do that. Reggie can't do that. I don't know who else was banned, but we are the ones who are most recently involved. And now we can't talk there. And one of the complaints that I had made in my comment was, hey, look, Graham, Graham Blake is the moderator. I said, hey, you moderate this forum by yourself. So no matter how hard you try to get rid of your bias, it would be helpful to just have another opinion from someone else who isn't affiliated with your company, right? Because he owns an LSAT company. He used to work for Seven Sage. And so I just invited him to invite other mods onto the moderation team. And again, we got banned. No response there, right? The other problem is that there are lots of resources out there, not only ours, but Blueprint, Testmasters, LSAT Lab. None of these resources, as much as we might disagree with their approach to the test, they are not listed as a resource on his subreddit, right? But his resource is listed at the very top, right below LSACs.
Yeah. Ben, you said that he's the only moderator of our LSAT, but there's four moderators of our LSAT.
And yeah, it's a little bit odd because each of those, first of all, we don't hear from anyone else. And each of those names kind of look like a variant of Graham Blake. So,
well, yeah, like three of them say Graham Blake. And then one of them is some other, it's like anonymous kind of looking thing. But it's like, it just very much gives the impression that he has four moderator accounts that are all him on our LSAT. He also is the moderator of our LSAT prep. He's the moderator of our law school admissions. He's the moderator of our pre-law. He has requested to take over our GRE preparation. And the more we dig into this, it just appears to be his entire marketing strategy for his company, which is an LSAT prep company, is to take over moderation of these Reddit subs and appear to be even-handed, but, you know, secretly or explicitly ban people who are his best competition.
Yeah. Well, you know what this reminds me of is it reminds me of that AI debacle that Google just went through.
Oh,
right. Everybody got upset because Google was adding in prompts to people's requests to Gemini. That's their large language model, right? And people got upset because they said, hey, we don't like the tweaks you're making to our comments. And the biggest concern here is not so much that you got caught for injecting controls over how our requests are processed. But when you don't get caught, you can push, you can nudge people in certain directions, right? And as people go more and more to these LLMs to get information about history or whatever, you can start to just slightly rewrite history. If you totally rewrite it, it's stupid and it's not effective. But I think that's the problem with this shadow ban is that people were saying things about the demon and they had no clue that their comments were being deleted or their posts. It's funny. In fact, you would see some people who would say something like, hey, what resource did you use? And the person would write, I used LSAT Demon. And then a few minutes later or an hour later, someone's like, hey, what resource did you use? And the person would comment with their, you know, that hand emoji pointing up.
This, like, I already
hey,
answered.
Idiot. Yeah. That's because they could see their comment, but no one else could. And they didn't know that unless they logged out and saw it as a, you know, just a general user. So, and who logs out, right? Everybody has their login saved, right? Anyways, that's my biggest concern is that as much as Graham may be trying to do the best he can, we don't know for sure, to try to moderate this forum fairly, there just seems to be things that he's either deliberately or, you know, maybe more likely just inadvertently not realizing that he's excluding. And it's not good because as much as people may hate the demon, there are also thousands of people who like it, right? We see them every day. We have all these people who are signed up and paying us money. Like if they hate it, like they would leave, right? And they could ask for a refund and all that sort of stuff, but that doesn't happen. Instead, people leave and they give us these positive reviews. So we know that there are people who really benefit from what we're offering. And yet, if you go to our LSAT or any of these other forums that Graham is moderating, you're never going to hear about us. And you're not going to probably hear as much about these other platforms as well. I mean, we haven't been focused on those, but
you'll hear about Seven Sage.
Yeah, you'll hear about that. Like,
used to work with.
Yeah.
And you'll hear about LSAT Hacks, which is his product. You won't hear about his best competitors, including us. I mean, I can believe actually that he believes our reviews are fake. The truth about us is that we're so good that our reviews sound fake. Like people are so happy that they use Demon for their prep that it just makes it sound fake, but it's real. I mean, and so we would encourage you to come check us out You know, just give it a shot and hopefully you'll be happy. We're going to continue, right? This whole bullshit of us getting totally unfairly banned on RLSet is not going to stop us. There are other forums out there. We will continue with the podcast. We will continue with our social media. We will continue with our Discord, all of our classes. You know, we have hundreds and thousands now of students. We just recently got to over 50,000 free accounts on LSAT Daemon. You know, we've helped 50,000 people for free. So apparently nobody's allowed to talk about that on our LSAT. But that's the truth about us. And this is not going to stop us.
No. Last thing I want to say is you can read more about this if you want to, although I don't think you need to waste your time doing so. But if you want to, you can go to lsat.link/Reddit. And there we link to my comment. We link to Graham's post. We try to just lay it out for you. But I want to double down on what you just said about testing us out, because that's one of the things I said in the comment. Like, if you think we're fake or trying to promote ourselves in these underhanded ways, then, you know, that reeks of desperation. Like, we don't actually have something of value. But no one has to go to Reddit or anywhere else to figure out whether it's a good product. You can try our product for free as long as you want. It's not like a month or something. It's indefinite, and it has hundreds of questions in there that you can try. And if you decide to do a paid product and you don't like it, within the first 30 days, you can ask for a refund, no questions asked. So people are doing it and they're staying with us. So there must be something there that they find valuable. But anyways, enough on that.
Enough on that. Leading off with your questions, RJ starts with how to get level 5 LR questions.
Hey, Ben and Nathan, I find myself in quite a predicament. I am now at the point where I can answer every question, every level 1 to 4 question with 98% accuracy. However, when I get a level 5 question, it's essentially a crapshot.
Crapshoot.
I consistently review these questions in practice tests and drilling, but I feel like I'm plateauing with these deviant questions. Do you have any advice on how to get better with these types of difficult questions? Thanks, RJ.
Seems impossible.
Okay.
Doesn't seem like it could possibly be true. There's just not that much of a difference between level 4 and level 5. How is it that you're really 98% accurate on level 1 to level 4? Which, by the way, you know, you really should be striving for 100% accuracy on those questions. Like, that's even more important. The ones that you are missing on those questions are probably more important than your problems that you're having with level 5. But it just seems kind of impossible that you could go from 98% accuracy on those difficulty questions all the way down to 50-50 on the level 5 questions.
Well, you know, I think actually something else might be going on here. And I guess this is a little bit consistent with what you're saying, but level 5 questions have a huge variation within them of difficulty.
Yes.
So there are level 5 questions in which 30% of test takers are getting them wrong. And that's a decent chunk. It might be even more, but at least based on our, you know, I shouldn't say test takers, I should say based on our students who are preparing, right? 30% of them are getting those questions wrong. And that indicates that it's a level 5 question. But there are also questions within level 5 in which 60-70% of test takers or students preparing for the LSAT are getting those questions wrong. And it's like, those questions are throwing a lot of people off. And RJ, you're probably noticing when you get those questions wrong, you're noticing that those are level 5, but you're also then forgetting about all the level 5 questions that you end up getting right.
So selection bias is what you're saying, which, yeah, that's why I'm saying it just doesn't seem like it's right. So what I think is, yes, I think, Ben, you are correct that RJ is getting, he's doing a lot better on level 5 questions than he realizes. It's just that when he looks at his mistakes, they tend to be a lot of level 5s, which makes total sense, especially because the very hardest level 5s are really, really hard. We did a class recently that was like just the weird ones. And, you know, it was like super double black diamond, where it was like, we're talking about bees vision. We're talking about the fish with the dioxin. we're talking about, I mean, it was just like all the greatest hits back to back to back to back to back. And if you look at those level five questions, then you're going to start to think, oh my God, these really are deviant. And like all level five questions look like this. But Ben, you're pointing out that all level five questions do not look even close to what those look like. Yeah, so be careful if you're like trying to study the very hardest questions and thinking that that's what it takes to get the level five questions right. I would assume it's roughly 1/5 of the questions that are labeled level five. But am I wrong about that? Maybe we should cut that.
No, it's not quite that, but it's close. Yeah.
Okay. So close to 1/5 of the questions are level five. Okay. There's a bell curve, and the ones that are harder than all the other ones, that the roughly 80th percentile questions, are going to be labeled as level five. But within those, there are a lot of very manageable, totally predictable questions. Just don't get so hung up on those weird ones.
Yeah.
You can go, you know, for Demon Live subscribers, if they want to go watch that class that I did, which was just the weird ones, you'll see me struggle with questions that I've taught like 30 times.
Yeah.
You know, so the lesson there isn't the LSAT is hard. The lesson there is, sure, there are a few of these actually deviant questions, and those do trip students up. But if you're only focusing on your mistakes, you're very likely to be running into those deviant questions with higher frequency. And you just don't need to get them right in order to score 170 or even 175. You do not have to get those deviant questions right. So, you know, if you're going to start scoring 175 plus, then yeah, I guess you're going to have to get most of the deviant ones too.
Mm-hmm.
But to get to 170, the easiest way is to slow down so much that you probably don't even reach that deviant question number 24 or 25 in time. You know, you just focused on getting 1 through 20 and 1 through 22 correct, and then you've got some random guesses on the end, which tend to be on the hardest, most deviant. You could think of them as like almost a bonus level in a video game, you know, where it's like, well, of course, this is so impossible. I have no chance of killing all these aliens. But the point of it is to just get as many points as you can during that phase, not to expect like that you have to do that in order to survive. Sorry for like a Galago reference, but anyway.
No, I think that's good. So RJ, keep going. Let us know what happens. Keep us updated. This next one is from Lawrence. The subject is getting questions wrong when doing time sections, but often always be able to do it right later.
Hi, Ben and Nathan and the LSAT Demon team. This is Lawrence. When I finish a timed section, I often think I did flawlessly, yet end up getting a few wrong each time. The interesting thing is, a great majority of the time, when I take a break and come back to it, I always get the right answer and can clearly articulate in my head why that answer choice is right. Somehow it just did not occur to me during the timed section or prep test to pick that answer, and it baffles me. I don't know where my main problem is, and hence do not know how to improve on these mistakes. Also, I always seem to be getting the 3-star difficulty questions wrong and the 5-star difficulty questions right, but I don't know if that is relevant or indicative of anything. It would be great if my concerns could be clarified for me. Best regards, Lawrence. Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, okay, a couple things could be happening here. One, you finish the section, your mind has an opportunity to let these ideas marinate a little bit, and then you come back to it, and you think that when you're doing it again, you're getting it right in that moment, but in reality, your mind has sorted it out. What can you do to solve that, though, is to maybe slow down a little bit more during the section. Maybe you have to do fewer questions and just feel more confident about the answers that you're picking. You say you don't know where your main problem is and hence do not know how to improve on these mistakes. But when you're reviewing it, it's not just, hey, okay, I can get the right answer now and I can clearly articulate in my head why that answer choice is right. You also have to stop and think about, okay, what was I thinking just 20 minutes ago or 5 minutes ago when I did this question? How did I think about it? And what likely led me to think in that way?
Well said. I think that Lawrence is, when he says I'm getting 3-star difficulty questions wrong and 5-star difficulty questions right, that to me clearly indicates that you got to slow down. You're mm-hmm. not understanding, Lawrence, where the vast majority of your points are going to come from on the test. And it's not from level 5 questions. It's from level 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. And the least important type of question, as we were saying above to RJ, the least important type of question is those level 5 questions. It's great that you can get them right. That's awesome. But missing level 3 questions is a simple matter of you're going too fast and you're just being sloppy. You have too much confidence, Lawrence. You're finishing the section and patting yourself on the back and thinking, yeah, another flawless performance. Then you look at your results and you realize, oh shit, I actually missed a bunch of these questions that I thought were easy. And when I review them, they are easy. Well, okay, then you just got to take a breath as you do those questions so that you can make sure to get one point in the bank instead of falling into what you're probably doing is you're falling into their, you know, they have some answers that are there to trap those who are not reading carefully enough. And you're getting trapped by those attractive, I'm doing air quotes, but attractive wrong answers. You clearly are falling into those traps instead of taking the time to see through them. And you need to be catching them, right? You need to be, ideally, as you're doing the test and going through the wrong answers, you're going to see those and you're going to kind of like, there's going to be a little recognition, little glimmer in your eye of like, aha, I see you, LSAT. I see what you're trying to do. I'm not falling for that bullshit. I'm going to read all 5 answers. I'm going to pick the one that's going to get me a point instead of picking the one that is the trap for people who aren't as good at this test as I am. Anything more for Lawrence?
Just one side comment, and that is we talked about this briefly earlier, but there are actually a lot more level 3 questions than level 5 questions.
Okay.
So when you say I always seem to be getting the level 3 questions wrong, there's got to be a bunch of them that you're getting right. You're probably just encountering a lot more of them too. Right? So like there's just not that many level 5 questions to get wrong.
So when you review again, when you review your mistakes, you're going to see a lot of level 3s that you missed potentially.
Yeah.
That's because there are more level 3s. If it's a bell curve, so it's not rough, it's not 20%.
It's not 20%.
In chunks. Okay. So it's probably more like 10% level 1, 10% level 5.
Well, actually it's kind of a lopsided bell curve. There's a lot of easy questions. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So it might not even be a bell curve. It's more like it's just kind of declines.
Well, it does. It there are more level 3s than 2s and 1s, but it's like a bell curve that starts high, goes up, and then drops.
Got it. Yeah. So the most common difficulty is level 3. The next most common difficulties are level 2, level 1, and 4.
Yeah, exactly.
And then level 5.
Yep.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. Yeah. But when you review, you will be likely to see. So, right. Yeah. Since there are so many level 3 questions, you're likely to be missing some of those on your reviews. You're also, of course, likely to be missing some level 5 since those are the ones that are missed by more students.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. All right. Anonymous is writing about Logic Games struggles.
Dear Ben and Nathan, I began studying for the LSAT on February 8th and have improved in every section except for the logic games. As of right now, I'm averaging a -3 in reading comp and a -5 in logical reasoning, but my logic games is fluctuating between -8 and -6. On my latest LSAT practice test, I scored a 165 with a -7 in games. I'm extremely worried that I won't be able to improve my games score in time for the June LSAT. My biggest issue with the games is how slowly I make deductions, which results in me rarely reaching the fourth game. Any recommendations for how I should focus my studying leading up to the June to try to improve on the games? Much appreciated, Anonymous.
Boy, if you could crack those games, you would be already in the 170s. That's awesome. Start looking at it as an opportunity instead of looking at it as an obstacle. If you're always going to see it as an obstacle, you could just decide that you're not going to take the test in June and you're going to take it in August after the games go away.
Yep.
At that point, though, you know, there's going to be an additional section of LR and you're -5 in LR. So it's not like you're that much better in LR than you are in games anyway. So I'm not sure that you're going to find that the August test is actually any better for you. Worrying about not being able to improve in time for the June test, man, as we record, this is March 19th. So you got April, May, June. I mean, you've got 3 months to prepare for the June LSAT. And 3 months is enough to make dramatic improvement on the games. If you did one section a day of games between now and then, you would do roughly one quarter of all of the Logic games that were ever released. And if you do a quarter of all of the Logic games ever released, you're going to see improvement.
Yeah.
I went from roughly where you're at to perfect in about 6 weeks. I think I actually made more improvement than that in 6 weeks, because I would get like two or three games, probably, like naturally, I would be able to just figure out two or three games in 35 minutes. But, you know, sometimes two games, which means shit, I've only got 12 points or whatever on the section. Random guesses on everything else gets me to like 14, 15 points on the section. That wasn't getting it done. So I studied the games every day, a little bit every day, like one section, maybe two sections a day for 6 weeks. And next thing you know, perfect. Not everybody's going to make that amount of improvement in that short of time. But it does happen, and it happens kind of frequently. I think if you have the time and you can work hard at it between now and then, like, it wouldn't surprise me at all if you scored perfectly on the games on the June LSAT. What do you think about this comment? My issue, my biggest issue, is how slowly I make deductions.
Yeah, that's not the issue, unless you're trying to make deductions in questions, in which case, yeah, maybe what Anonymous means is that he or she is getting stuck in, like, right, making tons of deductions, and that's what's going slowly.
Well, or doing that old school thing, which was like combining the rules together and looking for deductions instead of just building worlds to incorporate the rules. And if you make worlds, you will make deductions. You just need to learn how to make worlds, because you're going to bake rules in. And when you start baking rules in, then you're going to see how the rules impact one another. You're going to see how variables get restricted or how spots get restricted in the game. And then those restrictions just turn out to be the answers to the questions.
Yeah.
So, like, instead of worrying about not making enough deductions, instead flip that and focus on, I'm just baking in the rules here and seeing what happens when I bake the rules in. Then you'll be making the deductions effortlessly instead of like, do you see what I'm saying? It's like, people think that they have to like try to reach a conclusion. And instead, what you need to do is like valid reasoning. If you just do valid reasoning, then it leads to correct conclusions or deductions or inferences or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, you're basically taking that process of, okay, I'm going to combine this together with that and that to try to reach some deduction. Instead, it's like, let's just break it up into worlds and take baby steps. And those are so much easier.
Yeah. Exactly. And by the time you make a second baby step, you've already made a deduction.
Yeah.
You're realizing things without even knowing it. You don't have to be that conscious of it. Like, oh, I see now that X can't go third. No, it's just that your world's turned out such that X can't go third. And then that turns out to be one of the answers to one of the questions.
Yeah.
You're predicting the answers to questions that you haven't even seen yet. When you learn how to bake the rules in, you're solving the system. If you solve the system, then they can ask you whatever they want to ask you about it. You've already made a big list of deductions. So I think maybe that's what's happening here, is like Anonymous is searching for deductions. Like, I have so focused on, I have to have deductions. Or you can just bake your rules in to templates or worlds. And then once you have those, then you just go answer the questions.
Cool. This next one is from Lauren. The subject is, should I reapply? Follow-up.
That's a follow-up. Okay. Lauren wrote to us weeks ago. She was disappointed by her lack of offers from T14 schools, but WashU offered her a full-ride scholarship plus stipend. We advised Lauren not to settle and to try again next year. Sounds like us. We probably wouldn't have been super mad if she would have taken the stipend to wash you.
Yeah.
But because, you know, getting paid to go to law school, hard to lose.
Yeah.
Lauren says, it was an honor to make it on the podcast. You guys had a lot of questions, so here's more info if y'all are interested. My stats are 177, 4.0. I applied to 15 schools and had my personal statement reviewed by two pros, including our own, Leslie. I was waitlisted everywhere I applied except NYU, who never got back to me. I'll be visiting Wash U's admitted students weekend, and unless I fall in love with the school, we'll be following y'all's advice and reapplying next cycle with some work experience. I'm from a lower middle class family, so my family is aghast that I'm leaning toward turning down the full ride plus stipend and reapplying. Thank y'all for confirming my belief that reapplying is a reasonable option. I also have a question. Should waitlisted applicants write letters of continued interest to the T14? I feel like you guys might say no, because the odds of getting a full ride off the waitlist at a T14 are probably close to 0%. Would it be better to just concentrate my energy on reapplying? Does that feel like it's coming? Did she apply late?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out why she got so many waitlisted responses. Because with a 177 and a 4.0, that should not be the case.
Yeah. I wouldn't think so either. I mean, I think that she's probably still an undergrad or right out of undergrad. She's saying no work experience, and that could certainly have hurt her candidacy, you know, especially these days with law schools saying that they care more about work experience. U.S. News did change their rankings to, you know, to incorporate information about employment stats.
Yeah.
And so I can see schools being like, high stats, but never did anything. Like, has never held a job. Could, you know, is she going to actually be successful as a lawyer? I don't know. But my biggest concern is that she applied late in the cycle.
That's got to be it, because I still don't think that a 177 and a 4.0 would lead to so many waitlisted, you know, responses. No. So, but I guess to get to that specific question about writing these letters, you seem to have the wherewithal to resist bad offers or even great offers that are not as good as they could be. So I don't have a problem with you writing those letters. I do have a feeling that you're probably not going to get full rides, but you never know. 177, 4.0.
Yeah, it just seems that those should have been written a long time ago.
Yeah.
I think many schools, because of yield protection, right? I mean, this is, how about this? One theory is Lauren's getting yield protected.
It's possible. They look at those numbers and they say, you ain't coming here. So at least for some of those schools, obviously for some others, they're going to say we're the best. So
she's from a lower middle class family. I wonder if it's possible that if she's a URM, then she's like even an extra, extra great candidate. And I could see a school like UCLA or some other school that's just like barely in the top 14 looking at Lauren's application potentially and going, well, tell you what, let's waitlist her and see how interested she is in really coming here. If she doesn't give us a letter of continued interest, then we're going to just assume that she's already going to Harvard or whatever.
Yeah.
And then... especially if we think about like Harvard, Stanford, Yale being coin flips, even for the best students.
Yeah.
If she got tails, tails, tails on those Harvard, Stanford, Yale coin flips, and the other schools in the T14 were basically waitlisting her because of yield protection, then the letters of continued interest could be really super relevant here. But if she's asking us this question now in mid-March, it's like, wow, that's kind of late in the cycle. When did you apply? And if you would have applied sooner, then maybe you would have been getting those waitlist letters earlier, or you would have just been getting admitted earlier in the cycle instead of getting waitlisted later in the cycle.
Yeah.
Lauren, you really can't go wrong here. If you decide to take the full ride plus stipend to Wash U, I mean, worst that happens is you have to move to St. Louis. If you decide to reapply next cycle, you're you're rolling the dice, but you're such a good bet that it's worth rolling the dice on you. Yeah. And if I was your dad, I would definitely say, nah, let's shoot again. Cause you've got Harvard numbers, you've got Stanford numbers, you've got Yale numbers.
Yeah.
And you totally do. So, get some work experience, show back up again next year, looking better. As far as filing those letters now, Ben, I guess if she just got waitlisted, she could file those letters and see what happens.
Yeah, just out of curiosity. But also, of course, be totally ready to say no, because they're unlikely to be great. Or maybe they're amazing because they're like, oh, you're actually interested in us? Yeah, we'll give you a full ride. Who knows?
If I'm UCLA and I'm like, hey, I know that my yield is part of my ranking, I don't want to admit people that are going to turn me down because that lowers my yield, which lowers my ranking.
Yeah.
So I'm going to waitlist somebody like Lauren, who has numbers that are above my 75th percentile for both LSAT and GPA. Like, we think she looks like Harvard. We think she looks like Stanford. Why would she come here? Let's waitlist her and see what happens. Then you write the letter of continued interest, and they absolutely might come back with, okay, if we're going to admit her, we have to admit her big, because again, we don't want her to deny us.
Yeah.
How many people deny UCLA, Ben? This is public information. I'm going to go to LSAT. I want you to guess. I'm going to go to LSATdemon.com/scholarships because that's a quick way to get to the 509 report.
I have no clue. I'm just going to say 50%.
50%. Yeah. So let's see. So they accepted only 16.8% of the people who applied, but they had 6,457 completed applications, 6,500.
Okay.
They offered admission to 1,085, 1,100 of those, 17%.
Okay.
But then they only had 301 enrollees from the applicant pool. Hmm. So 301 divided by 1085 is lower. It's less than 30%.
Yeah.
So the reject rate that UCLA faces, right? Their yield is only like 25%.
Yeah.
That means that of the people that they admit, only like 25% say, okay, fine, I'll take your offer.
Yeah.
They have to hate that. That's got to suck for them.
Yeah.
So then again, when someone like Lauren applies with, she's 6 points above their 75th percentile LSAT, and she's above their 75th percentile UGPA. You know, she's got a 4.0. They've got a 3.98, which is damn good, but she's better than that. So she's way above their medians. She's even above their 75th percentile. She's way above their 75th percentile on LSAT. And they know that they get rejected 3 times for every one time that someone actually says, okay, yeah, I meant it.
Yeah.
Well, then that waitlisting strategy could be smart of them from yield protection. So I guess my hypothesis would be that what happened here was some combination of doesn't have work experience, which you can remedy by working for a year, reapplying next cycle. You're going to show these schools that you're really serious if you show up with early applications next cycle. 2, she could have lost a bunch of coin flips at the top schools. Because it really is random. In a lot of those cases, you know, it really is random. They have limited spots.
Yeah, how do you decide between a 177 4.0 and a 177 4.0? Like, how?
Right. When you're getting 10,000 applications when you're Yale actual law school, right? So lack of work experience could have hurt her.
Yep.
Losing some coin flips at the very top.
Yep.
Little bit of yield protection. Could be just a tough cycle. Which I think we know it is. I think we know that there are tons of applications this cycle. Lots of bad things here. Oh, late applications.
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure she applied later in the cycle than we would have liked. Those 5 things lead to a whole bunch of wait lists in the top 14. Yeah, but your numbers are so great that I would definitely tell your folks that we should just, let's run it back and see what happens. Because you're really unlikely to have a similarly bad next cycle.
Yep.
Awesome. That was fun. Thanks for the update on that, Lauren. Appreciate it. Next one is from Morgan. The subject is transfer GPA explanation on application? Question mark.
Hi, Ben and Nathan. I will be applying to law schools in the fall. I was wondering if I should put an explanation of my transfer GPA from my community college on my application. Okay. My transfer GPA was a 3.7. This is considered low to the school I would likely apply to. And so far in my second semester at my university, I have only gotten one B. It was my first semester at this university. All the other classes last semester and this semester were and will be A's. Here's the thing. When I was at my community college, I was also in high school, so I was handling a full high school course load and 12 college semester hours at the same time, as well as working a part-time job and doing extracurriculars. Should I explain my two course loads and extracurriculars with which contributed to a low GPA?
Transfer GPA was a 3.7, but Morgan doesn't say, what's your overall UGPA?
Yeah, all A's except 1B.
All A's except 1B. So better than that.
Yep. Damn, that's quite the course load. High school student doing 12 college semester hours at the same time. It's a lot.
Yeah. You know, I think schools these days, like high schools these days, I think they're doing their students a bit of a disservice by forcing them into encouraging them to take so many college credits. I have a feeling you've got guidance counselors that are telling you, oh, well, to make your college application look better, you should start taking community college classes, or yeah, you've got extra periods to work with here in high school. You could start working on community college credits. And what they don't realize is that if you don't get straight A's in those community college credits, it's going to later end up biting you on your grad school applications.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is they're looking at costs and they're saying, oh, look, you could take these classes here. They're dual enrollment. So actually they're free because you're a high schooler, but then they can be used as credit in college. So now you can save money when you're in college because you can take fewer classes. But yeah, there's other things to consider. I
write a two sentence.
Yeah.
Two sentence addendum. Is that what you're gonna say? Same thing?
Same thing, yeah. Talk about your 12 college semester hours at the same time as doing high school work and probably your part-time job. I wouldn't add in the extracurriculars. It just sounds like you're piling on.
And get straight A's from now on. I mean, you have to run out the string with straight A's. That will make this story actually hold water.
Yeah.
Because every B you get undermines this significantly. Your transfer GPA is only a 3.7. 3.7 is
not
pretty
that bad.
Good.
Yeah.
3.7 is A minuses across the board. Getting all A's and a B here and there is also a 3.7. So far, it doesn't seem like you've done really spectacularly better than that 3.7 to begin with.
Yeah.
You know, if a skeptical reader would look at you and go, well, but you haven't done any better in college, so what are we supposed to do here? That said, if you actually have a ton of A's, just nothing but A's in your final year or however much you have left, then you can point to, unfortunately, my transfer GPA doesn't reflect the student that I really am. You'll see that I have a 4.0 for the last three semesters in my undergraduate
or whatever
education.
Maybe it's a 3.98, right? But yeah,
whatever it is, it's some higher number. You give them the opportunity to anchor on that higher number, and you then explain the 3.7 was the result of a full high school course load plus 12 college semester hours at the same time, in addition to a part-time job and extracurricular activities.
Yeah.
And then that's it. But like the goal of it is to just show them the better performance more recently.
Yep.
That's the only thing that's going to actually make this story make any sense. Appreciate it, Morgan.
Yeah.
Okay. Two more things here. We have a new product in the works, Ben. We have an admissions course that is being created by our personal statement editor, Leslie. And we have a wait list that is open now for this admissions course. Yeah. It is lsat.link/admissions. If you want to join the wait list, there's a bunch of questions there. And one of the questions that we wanted to talk about was, what type of a thing do you really want us to create? So the options, and this question is on the wait list. Again, you can go to lsat.link/admissions if you're interested in this course and want to sign up for it. It'll be a standalone course that is just only admissions focused. Mm-hmm. And as we develop the content, we're curious what type of interactivity you want in the class. So do you want a video course that you can buy and complete anytime at your own pace? Do you want a 6-week video course that starts on specific dates and has modules that come out once a week? Do you want a hybrid course with all that stuff plus some interaction with your cohort or with your tutors, like comes with live classes? Do you want a hybrid course that has videos plus individual one-on-one tutoring or individual one-on-one personal statement help? Or do you want an 8-week course, you know, something a little bit longer, more robust with all of that stuff, you know, and you're just super excited about the product and you want the most help you can get? Of course, as the product gets bigger and bigger, then the price would correspondingly have to go up. But we're just trying to figure out what people really want when they say they want an admissions course. What do you actually want? So that's just one of the, that's one of the questions that's in this wait list for the admissions course, which again is at lsat.link/admissions for anybody who's interested.
Cool.
Word of the week?
Yeah, let's do it. All right. Wow. We have a audio recording?
Yeah, somebody actually did it. So we have an audio recording here. Eric is going to play a short clip here from Chris. Thanks, Chris, for writing in.
Hey, Ben and Nathan, this is Chris R. So first, a book recommendation. I've been reading this book named Never Split the Difference by an author by the name of Chris Voss. He was a lead negotiator, the lead negotiator for the FBI for however many years. And he worked for the FBI for a 30-some year career. And what he posits is that everything in life is a negotiation. And it kind of reminded me of your guys' approach to college admissions, or really law school admissions. Nate, I know that you frequently talk about reading your Kindle. I think you'd really enjoy picking up this book. And there's been some really good word recommendations, or I don't want to say word recommendations, but vocabulary notes that I've taken since I started reading it. So the first one that I found in the book was inchoate, I-N-C-H-O-A-T-E. Hope you guys are well. Thanks for the podcast and the great work. Bye.
Ben, have you ever read this book, Never Split the Difference?
I have, more than once.
What do you think of it? Oh, more than once, so I guess you like it.
Yeah, I liked it. It's about negotiating with people. It's insightful about how people think and human behavior and perspectives. I think it's interesting. I don't know that, what am I trying to say? It's not like I read the book and then I can just go out and start negotiating like a baller with everybody I encounter. But I did think it was interesting just to like see these perspectives and kind of take a different angle on how you might approach negotiating.
Negotiations is fascinating. I took a negotiations class in business school. I think I probably also took a negotiations class in law school. I think I am still a horrible, horrible negotiator, but I maybe I'll get a little bit better because thank you to Chris for suggesting this book. I just went on Libby and checked it out and sent it to all of sent it to my Kindle. So cool. That'll add to my reading list. The word that was suggested, inchoate. What do you think about inchoate?
So this is a word I remember learning in law school, but now I'm trying to remember what the definition was. I feel like it's tacit or implicit or something like that, but I could be wrong.
I'm going to say that inchoate means very similar to incoherent.
Okay.
It's got a lot of the same letters. That doesn't mean it's the same word, but it very frequently does mean the same thing because it came from the same roots. In at the beginning of that word does, I think, indicate opposition probably. Starting with I-N probably means opposition to something. And incoherent would be the opposite of coherence. Inchoate, maybe coate has something to do with coherence. So yeah, I don't know. I'm looking for incoherence.
But you know what's so weird too is I kind of remember learning this word in criminal law, but my definition could be totally wrong.
Yeah, so I was wrong. Click on so definition of inchoate, according to Merriam-Webster.com, being only partly in existence or operation. It means the same as incipient.
Oh, wait, I'm remembering now. So it's like if you're planning to commit a crime, but it hasn't been fully formulated.
Ah, what you're that's gonna an inchoate crime.
Or something like that. Like maybe your premeditation is not fully formed, maybe, or maybe the crime hasn't been completed. I don't know.
Well, like if we were going to cash out, you know, if the Saudi prince came to us and said like, hey, I'm going to give you $10 million in gold bullion if you take the LSAT for me.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And we were like, you know, and we were like, okay, we were like making plans to do it. Like, send me your photograph or whatever. Like, okay. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I start Googling like how to create fake IDs or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, so maybe that's an inchoate crime. Especially, it says, especially if it is an imperfectly formed or formulated. So like, it actually, in a lot of usages, it's going to suggest that it's like maybe there's something wrong with it potentially.
Wait,
but anyway,
and then it says formless / incoherent.
Oh, incoherent. Okay, so hey, I got part of it right. Words have multiple meanings, but the first definition, that incipient thing, it just means, I think that is really what the word probably means more, is it means like, well, this thing isn't yet fully formed. You're not just saying that something is incoherent, because something could be fully formed and incoherent. Graham's case against us for shadow banning us on r/LSAT is, it's fully formed. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Inchoate would mean more like it's not even fully formed yet and possibly incoherent.
Yeah.
Cool.
I'm going to add this really quick. So inchoate is the word that's spelled I-N-C-H-O-A-T-E.
Yes.
Cool.
Inchoate.
Oh, and we keep saying, or I keep saying inchoate, but the little pronouncer here on Merriam-Webster anyway says inchoate.
Inchoate. Okay.
Inchoate. Yeah. All right. There you go. That's word of the week. You can be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us on our website, thinkinglsat.com, or on socials at LSAT Demon. If you have questions about the LSAT Demon, you can email help@lsatdemon.com. Please check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 447 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.